topic, and she has it for you. Gets us right into the business of our country. What is really on our plate immediately. We've resolved some questions concerning our leadership, but nevertheless, whoever is the leader has to deal with what potential, the harsh reality of potential true depression. So we want to explain the depression of 1907 and the possible depression coming from the financial crisis of the housing crisis, we call it, 2007. And it's nice to see the 100-year difference. Seems like it seems intriguing that there was something that occurred in 1907 that we can look to and learn from. And actually also learn about how America and how we the people respond in financial crises. We know how we respond individually, don't we? Ever have one of those? Mm-hmm. Okay, and what do you immediately do, you see? Because you multiply yourself by 250 million and see where we get, okay? And through the years. And so it's an interesting thing to look at how we behave economically, how we manage our own, shall we say, economy. Because, again, that produces a national events. And so, experiencing sort of, I've been there, okay, deja vu, I've been there already. Is that right, Tara?
Yeah.
Something like that? Okay, she's my expert in that show. Economic depression, 1907-2007. So if you join me on the presuppositions, right, there's some things that I want to highlight that I'm building upon. And I'm going to deal with what we have as a result of our history, the free market system, and what that is. It's the voluntary exchanges of goods and services between individuals without a third party, without coercion or interference of a third party, which could be price fixing, subsidies, which is artificial pricing. And I know some of you may have taken Economics 101 about that limitation of it, but basically it's just voluntary buying and selling and exchanging without any interference. And so that both of you serve your needs and wants without, again, intrusion. And there's a just exchange where both are satisfied. And it's an equal, mutual exchange. Both sense the benefits. And this happens in a setting where both of you have protection of property by law, and where dishonesty is punished, where fraud is punished. Again, civil government is there to punish which anything that violates individual life, liberty, and property. And so I will submit to you that the idea of free market system, non-interference, is the natural outgrowth of the spirit of individual liberty and self-government that's inherent to our own history, in particular to this history of America. You know, when you deal in free market exchanges, you really deal with uncertainty, right? You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if anyone's going to buy your goods. You don't know whether or not the goods you have are available, and all of this, but really you're dealing with uncertainty. And any time we manage our affairs in an atmosphere of uncertainty, it requires faith in something. True? Mm-hmm. And when there is no substance of faith operating in such a situation, you're going to want things fixed. It's a natural inclination, don't you? Mm-hmm. You're going to want to make it happen right. You want a happy outcome. You want to fix it so you don't have to worry about any uncertainty. You want certainty. And this is where you invite, perhaps, an interference. And you consider what quality of individual would engage in free enterprise or free market system. It takes an individual who is at liberty, and who has a measure of self-government. Just consider that. Thomas Sewell says that it never precludes economic downturns nor failures. It doesn't mean that there will not be any such thing, but he says, I like what he says, for everything human can fail. The liability, the probability of failure in business is all out there. And when you're afraid of failing, you want to fix it so you don't fail. Right?
Yes.
That's human nature. And at least fix it so you don't fail. Somebody else could fail, but so you don't fail. I mean, this is the idea. But we have to assume that risk and faith is involved in this idea of a free market with no interference of a third party. However, what you have is simply opportunity for prosperity. And it's always there in a free market. It's open to you to engage and to fail or succeed. But the opportunity for success is there without any interference, without any hindrance, per se. Markets will readjust themselves whenever there is, again, mistakes made, poor products, or any, shall we say, products that don't fly, as it were, don't sell. But markets will adjust themselves in a free market. People pay a price for their mistakes. We don't like to pay for our mistakes, but in a free market, you're allowed to make a mistake and pay for it dearly. Your investment, your capital, loss, experiencing loss, that's painful. But that means I'll never do that again, okay?
Right.
Right? I mean, but that's it. You have the opportunity to fail as well as succeed. But the success is all yours. You see, and that's the incentive. Government interventions are usually based on trying to stop them from having to pay that price. And again, if we are a people that are shy of paying for the mistakes we ourselves make, then that speaks of a character that invites control. Control of your economy. Control.
Yes.
It's just, you invite it. Welcome it. And look at in your own household. How many times parents want to intervene so their children can't fail? In fact, we do that today. You're playing sports out there and you don't keep score. There's no such thing as losing. You're not accustomed to ever losing. How are you ever going to win if you never lose? Or learn to excel or to improve. There's nothing about it. And so that philosophy could undermine, again, a whole economy because we apply that to every other area of our lives. I can't lose. I can't afford to lose. I don't want to lose. It's going to hurt my feelings. I feel like a failure. Right? But all of that psychology comes in. And we don't become strong from our mistakes. And you can apply that not just in the economy, but your personal life in every area. We're human. Okay? You forget, we're simply human beings. Then another aspect we have to look at as far as how depression came in 1907 and 1930, 1929 to 1930, and now potentially from here on out. Because from here on out, as you observe the current events of our nation, we are on an economic decline. We're not depressioned yet or depressed yet, but that seems to be the trend. And so we have to look at it, and it's going to affect every one of us. We can't escape it. And how do we get there? So what is the right approach? How can you prepare? And what are we paying the price for? Okay, we're paying a price for something. You know, it's the old adage. That's really scripture. What you sow, you're going to have to reap. It may take 60 years, but you got to eat it. You got to eat your own stuff. That's why I don't like to cook. I have to eat it. I eat raw before I cook. Okay. But that's basically it. You know, it's your own stuff. So Congress, by 1913, we don't want to pay for our mistakes anymore. Congress acted unconstitutionally. That's amazing. In 1913, I think that's the same year that the income tax was instituted. It transferred its monetary, the Constitution, what about the Constitution again? We want to get right with ourselves. We want to get an adjustment. You know, you go to a chiropractor, get your bones in place, you know, you're out of whack, you're not standing straight, you're not walking right, don't feel right, you're disjointed. We as a nation possibly could be disjointed because we're not in alignment with this document called the Constitution. And we have, and it says here in the Constitution that monetary responsibility is in Congress. Isn't that wonderful? We the people, we're in charge of our own money. We're supposed to be. We're in charge of the amount of money we have in the nation and how the value of it. And to make it uniform throughout the country, but we decide the value and the currency of this nation. But it gave that responsibility over to a private corporation, private banks. It's simply called the Federal Reserve Bank. It's and in that, so I'll give you what the Constitution says about that, and there's nothing the Constitution says that they surrender it to a private corporation, a private entity. But now we have a consortium of banks that have all our money. They decide how much money the nation has in supply. And all the banks of the country are under the rule of this one bank, the Federal Reserve Bank. They have 12 throughout the country, but they're all attached. So all the banks are regulated. Banks used to be a private enterprise. Banks used to be like your store where you buy eggs and, you know, your grocery store, where you get money and they manage and exchange. I mean, that secure your funds. But this made it all under, again, one body of individuals. And so, why did they do that? They created the Federal Reserve with the intent, what was the intent? Of preventing failures, okay, in the bank. All right? We don't want to fail, called bank panics. And any depression that might want to come. We don't want to suffer nationally a decline in our economy and suffer joblessness, suffer inadequate supply of goods and services, and again, the inadequacy to purchase these things. So they control the money supply, the flow of money, and how much money costs to borrow. That's why interest rates go up and down. They control how much money costs. That's what a loan is. How much it costs to get, to be in debt, I suppose. And so, what was this government interference to control? Now, this is an effort. This is interesting. Government effort to control what's really uncontrollable. You are uncontrollable. Your behavior cannot be controlled. You can't even control yourself. Right? How can you control a whole nation? But they're trying to have models and predictions. Okay. They're trying to use it as science. Now, if we were predictable, right, if you could somehow, but we're individuals. And no two individuals will think alike at one time. Thank God. But the nature of our individuality cannot be controlled. You don't know what people are thinking, what they're going to do next. But their intent is to control it so that there be no failure and control the actions, independent actions as well as the behavior of populations. And there are unintended consequences in all of these. But remember, government isn't God. Otherwise, it'd be possible, okay? That's the only individual I know, anybody I know, that could possibly control the world in this way, where it's understandable. There's a fear of failure and loss in the general public, is it not? I mean, nobody wants to lose. However, it is in our sphere. It is within our own decision. Otherwise, we lose the ability to make decisions. Do you understand? You have a price to pay for this, you know, this tool or this arm of rescue. And that is you lose your ability to make your own decision. And that is what we call liberty. So there's no faith and trust in the liberty and self-government of any people. You can't trust we the people. You can trust a few. And that would be the Federal Reserve Bank. That's what we're putting our trust in. This board of Bernanke, he's the current head of that. But there's a whole board of advisors, everything, and several banks. But they're the ones that will decide for us to keep. So it's like a thermostat. I'm going ahead of myself a little bit. But if it gets a little bit cold, we'll raise it up. If it gets a little warm, we'll just keep it up and down so that there will be no dips, no high, you know, inflation and deflation. So that's what they're doing, so that there will be no drop, no decline. Well, what happens? So let me suggest here that government interventions or regulations in the marketplace, they're not divine interventions. They're not going to be perfect. In fact, they make matters worse. And I want to illustrate how they do that by the Great Depression of 1930. That was the greatest, worst financial crisis in the history of our country in 1930. I think Ronald Reagan said that we almost bled to death as a nation. Mm-hmm. It lasted 10 years, and it didn't have to last 10 years. It could have been corrected. So economists like Milton Friedman and Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams teach today, having looked back and really analyzing it. And they teach it one way when the facts are really another. And so I know how we've been taught about the cause of the Great Depression, but I want to offer you another view of it. Just to understand the economy here, the business cycle. So most of you in here have your own entrepreneurial enterprise. You're business people. And you understand the nature that there are ups and downs. They're just essentially ups and downs. People change their mind about your product. Yeah? Or they find something a little bit more appealing than yours. It's just the nature of business, of free exchange. And so there are four phases in any business cycle, now as a nation, all right, in a nation as well as a small business. There is the contraction, slowdown. Now you can see contraction by this, sometimes by seasons, right? Mm-hmm. Right, the tea shop, and right, I have a contraction when the school's out. Nobody wants any school products anymore. See, it's all, you know, that there's that part. And you have to plan, you have to foresee, and you have to prepare for. But it's that government of yourself. That's the liberty you have. No one's going to come in here and force people to buy your products, but that could help you, right? Or there'll be no contraction. But again, it's that interference. Then there's a trough, again, gets to the lower turning point of a business cycle, where contraction turns into an expansion. So there's that lull, we call, and then it builds up again. It's just an observation here. Then there's expansion, and then there's peak. And so this is sort of what economists have said. This is the typical cycle in a free market without any interference. However, when there's interference, a business cycle is not, again, predictable. It changes. It is, again, the uncertainty of these things. It's hard to prepare and look for. And as a result, again, this is where risk comes in. Now, a recession occurs if a contraction is severe enough. What does that mean? Today, they say two consecutive quarters of decline in the gross domestic productivity or income, as they say. And so if we analyze statistically, if there is a minus growth in two quarters in any business or in the nation, generally speaking, the gross national domestic, then we are in recession. And from reports that I hear, we're not yet in recession. Actually, we did last quarter have a small increase. That's amazing, because the news seems like it's just so dismal. But we're not there. We're really not there. We're hanging in there. But it doesn't mean that it won't happen. It doesn't mean it won't happen. We are getting less in productivity. but it's not recession time yet. So if we're aware of this, we can make a contribution to slow it down, to slow the process into depression if we are aware of these things. And so it's determined by judgment rather than, again, a formal rule. It's just an observation that people make. And again, market economies are self-adjusting, and that's why they're not predictable. People will change their minds and do things in a way that may, compensate, they call adjustment, compensate for weaknesses. And maybe you'll introduce a new product, right, that you didn't before. All these things that people are liable to do. Or again, it's wonderful things sometimes, surprises. Don't you get wonderful surprises in business? You know, you may get a great sale, or you may get a contract you didn't foresee. But all these things make enterprise an adventure. That's the nature of individual enterprise. It's an adventure. And it's full of, there is that ability of good as well as, again, decline. Increase as well as decline. And so a depression is a deep, what they call a deep trough. Now, in our history, there have been six depressions, 1873 to 79, 93 to 97, 1907 to 1908, and all these. There have been six in our history that have been recorded. And it's a severe, what they call, economic, that lasts several years, okay? So if we are to venture into a depression, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about years. All right, of decline, and negative productivity. Okay, negative productivity. Yes.
Do you think that we're in a recession now?
It's no. Yeah. By the way, we've had negative and then positive, negative, but it has to be two quarters succeeding, and so we've had dips, and so people cry recession, but basically you can count on two quarters of negative growth. And so we hang in there by the skin of our teeth, okay? But it is very, again, declining.
Right? Two quarters is 6 months.
Pardon?
Two quarters is 6 months.
Yes, right. 6 months. So, you know, maybe it's time to close shop if it gets that way, or yourself, right? You have to decide, too, when is the time to close shop and turn, you know, or turn around. It's really, again, that uncertainty we're talking about. And Ron Paul, some of you may be familiar with him, he's a congressman, but it's interesting here, from the Great Depression to the stagflation of the 70s, some of you weren't even born yet, to the burst of the dot-com bubble last year, this is written in year 2002, every economic downturn suffered by the country over the last 80 years can be traced to what? Federal Reserve policies. It's called interference, all right? And so this Federal Reserve Bank is supposed to keep everything in good harmony has really not produced what is intended. The Fed has followed a consistent policy of flooding the economy with easy money. They make money, right? They put money into the supply, and that of course makes every other dollar now less value. And so, in order to stop the deflation, they take the money out of circulation, and so they do those things from the bank. So this is what they're trying to do. Well, what about the 1907 bankers' panic? Have to understand what a bank is. What's its proper function? It is to oversee, superintend, as it were, the what money put into the bank, whether it's in your checking account, savings account, CDs, money markets, that is entrusted them by savers, by investors. So that's the duty of a bank, is to supervise. And a banking panic may be defined as a shock whose origin can be found in any sudden and unanticipated revision of expectations of deposit loss, where there's usually an unsuccessful attempt to convert checking deposits into currency. In other words, that you can't get your money out of the bank. It's not there when you go to withdraw it, all right? And some of us were concerned about Wamu, all right? And that's what happened to the banking, Wachovia, is it Wachovia, Wachovia, all right? And a few other banks, but yes.
Historically, when do you think the first bank was developed?
National Bank?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was, of course, the administration of Washington had been
Washington.
But they didn't renew it.
Right.
And then Jefferson didn't, and then it came along mm-hmm. later. There were only two, and I think Andrew Jackson had one. So mm-hmm. there were two before, mm-hmm. then there was none.
Uh-huh.
Okay, until 1913.
Wow.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have here, so it's a rational response by depositors when they hear information there might be not enough money. They're just going to rush the bank when they sense that there may not be enough reserved in the bank for them to get their money out. That's basically it. That's a natural human response, isn't it? If you hear a rumor that the bank's investments are failing and they can't, my money's not there, they couldn't give me the money, or they don't have enough money to give back their investors, you're going to be make sure you're first in line so I want to get my chunk out, right? And that's a rush on the bank. And that's basically what happened in 1907. There were poor investments made, and you know, there are sometimes criminal activity that can happen. That's part of the risk, and that comes in free market. But that's the free market, absolutely. The 1907 panic was a financial crisis when money demand quickly rises relative to money supply. That's basically, there wasn't enough money to cover all the deposits. And as the stock market fell nearly 50% from its peak in 1907, people were withdrawing their funds. The economy was in recession at this time. When the public found out that currency was not available, they demanded all the more, getting it out of the market, precipitating the fractional reserve collapse. That is, every time you put money in the bank, then the bank was, the practice was to reserve some of it and invest the rest of it, you see. But if you want all of it, it's really not there, okay? And it's based on trust. It's based on trust. And when the bank makes poor investments with your money, all right, then they don't profit, and they can't really restore the money that you put in. That's basically it. And again, wanting to again get that money out and return in profit. Numerous runs on banks, and of course the problem of now pre-1914 banking. There were then government restrictions, not Federal Reserve. There was no Federal Reserve then. And it did not allow them to give banknotes, promissory notes, instead, with interest. And if they could have done that, then they could have slowed down the bank run. And so, what was to be done when this downturn began to happen and money was not available and everything was, again, ready to collapse? Well, the idea here is that you quell panics, you resolve panics by having some collective action to rescue institutions and to get the confidence back. And so, how many of you ever watched It's a Wonderful Life? Remember that bank run?
Yeah.
And he was bargaining. Now, come on, how much can you really, you know, how much can you really, really need now? Come on, how about just a dollar? And they were restricting, all right, trying to keep the bank solvent. I think he had $1 left at the end of the day, ready. But that was the point. That was the independent bank working. And again, would promise that that there'd be another day and another deposit someone will make the next day to come in. May be asked for. But remember, there was no Federal Reserve, there was no National Bank. And this banker's panic was resolved by one individual. Now, J.P. Morgan is a controversial figure. It doesn't matter. His personal life, his motives, his conspiratorial ideas, that's beside the point. Get that out of your mind. He saved the day by putting his own money and other bankers' monies into the system. Do you understand? It was, of course, he was a financier. It was his bank and others' banks, and he put his own personal assets to stop the run and supply, and he stopped the national depression. I mean, he quelled it. And restricting the kinds of payments they were making, restricting the withdrawals, as it were. And so here in 1907, we had it resolved when one man and others together put in their funds. And this is free market, all right? It's the private entrepreneur, it's the private doing it. In what we have today in 2007, it's the government making more money, right, and taking what's called the bailout. It's not by private, it's by government, and it doesn't resolve it. Let's look at the Federal Reserve Bank, just to define it. This is where the government now is making sure there's no more bank panic, and it's going to control the operations of all the banks in the country. This is the central banking system. This is what you call centralizing banking. Okay, no longer independent, all tied together. And it's in 1913 under Wilson, President Wilson's Woodrow Wilson's term. And And the Board of Governors, by the way, is appointed by the President. Interesting. It's Congress's responsibility. But this board is appointed by the President, all right? And so, again, it increases the power of the presidency, doesn't it, in that regard? It's supposed to be Congress, but again, it makes it important here. There is that conflict of interest, you might say. Again, we have 12 reserve banks. This is sort of the structure of it. And councils today, Ben Bernanke serves as the chairman of the board, etc. Now, it was attempt to prevent or minimize the occurrence of bank runs and to respond appropriately when they do happen. And so they're supposed to intervene. They're supposed to be able to be the last resort. Banks can borrow from the Federal Reserve if they're losing funds. If they find a bank run and they can't meet the demand, then they can borrow from the Federal Reserve. Or the Federal Reserve can step in, as it were. They act as a lender of last resort by extending credit to depository institutions or to other entities in unusual circumstances involving a national or regional emergency where failure to obtain credit would have a severe adverse impact on the economy. Through its discount and credit operations, reserve banks provide liquidity to banks to meet short-term needs stemming from seasonal fluctuations in deposits or unexpected withdrawals. And so this is the backup. This is your backup. Now, in its role as a central bank of the United States, the Federal serves as banker's bank. Again, here we have a tier and a hierarchy of control. And it's the government's bank. As the banker's bank, it helps to assure the safety and efficiency of the payment system. That's the intent, anyway. That's the intent. And they also produce money. They are the ones that put money in the system. And again, they produce all the bills, all the bonds, and all of this. This is how they manage themselves. Financial transactions, involving trillions of dollars. Just as an individual might keep an account at a bank, the U.S. Treasury keeps a checking account with the Federal Reserve through which incoming federal tax deposits and outgoing government payments are handled. So that's where our tax money goes in the Federal Reserve, okay, all our payments. They distribute it or they handle the government's money, as it were. And they print money. They produce the nation's cash supply. And so all the cash supply, which means all the debt payments we make, mortgages and things, go to the Federal Reserve. Do you understand? That's where the money is. It doesn't go into the control of Congress. It goes to this Federal Reserve Bank. And all our money is in their hands, or as it were. Private banks for non-profit businesses, but government regulations places restriction on what they can do. And that's basically how they regulate, again, the banking system, the banking industry. The Fed sets money policy, making decisions about the total amount of money in the economy, also known as the money supply. It either tightens or loosens the access to money by interest rates or by printing more money or again, taking it out of the supply. Now, I want to look at the Keynesian economics. This is the policy. This is the philosophy of management that we've had since 1940 to even to this day. This is what Congress And our, I think, our country has operated on. This is what they're thinking. This is the philosophy. Now, it began in 1936 by General Theory of Employment. This is what he said. According to Keynes, what drives the economy is aggregate demand or aggregate expenditures. This is why they call you consumers. They want to get you to spend, because if you spend, they'll keep jobs going, okay? The more you buy, all right, then the more you keep people working in the job market. And so they don't want you to save. They want you to spend. They don't want government to stop spending. They want them to spend into debt. All right. And they supply the monies, and they will be the lenders. That's why you have a charge card before you graduate from college, so that you keep spending and keep it going. All right. And you get to borrow from them, and they get your interest. All right. But that keeps it going. It's called deficit spending. Just keep yourself spending, all right? This is the idea. This is what keeps jobs, is your spending, which is not reasonable. Aggregate demand can be broken down to three main components. Personal consumption. Now, you know what a consumer is? Consumer means a waster. They depend on you being a waster. They used to call us customers. That's why we don't get good service. Because we go in there and just waste away, right, all our money. And they know it. We'll buy anything that doesn't move. Okay? I mean, we're just taught to buy, buy, buy. It's a bargain. I used to be taught, I would say, oh, this is savings. This is on sale. And I can hear my mother now. You would save everything without buying anything. I mean, you would really save if you didn't buy it, right? It's no savings. It's spending. And it's a consumer mentality. Based on this Keynesian philosophy of deficit spending to keep the economy going. Private investment and government expenditures. The relationship can be summed up with this formula, AD equals C, etc. If aggregate demand is strong, the economy will be strong. However, if aggregate demand falters, businesses will end up with large unsold inventories and will cut back on production to avoid surpluses in the future. As they cut back, they will, of course, need fewer inputs, including labor, and high unemployment will result. And that's the model. You've got to keep people spending in order to keep people with jobs. Does that sound reasonable? It sounds reasonable in some sense. Now, what is required to avoid a recession? That is for the government to ensure that the aggregate expenditures are enough to achieve full employment. And so the government can do that through either fiscal policy, taxing, and government spending, or monetary policy control the money supply. And so if what the private sector does not spend, the government will compensate by government program spending to keep the work, the money going, all right? The jobs going. We'll create jobs by government contracts. Government thinks we'll buy it. And so that's the deal here. What the private sector doesn't do, the government will do, but to keep this ongoing expenditures. Thus, increased government spending could neutralize any decreased expenditures in the private sector, preserving employment and incomes and ultimately reversing the pessimistic expectations that led to the downturn in the first place. So, and of course, Milton Friedman says this, okay, it's true, consumer spending accounts for about 70% of our nominal gross domestic product. Amazing, 70%. But that doesn't cause anything. It's 2% or 3% or 5% of the population who are the risk takers, the entrepreneurs, the innovators who cause the growth in the first place. It's their business, right, that allows this to occur. To summarize what happened in the Great Depression, 1929-1941. Basically, remember we said that the Federal Reserve was a last resort lender. It steps in and it puts money into banks or supplies the money when they're threatened of closure. Well, it just happened to occur that in 1930, they didn't do it. They sat idle, as it were. The most important cause of bank runs that began in October 1930 was bad times in the Farm Belt. So we had some banks in the Midwest that were in trouble because farmers could not pay their debts. And that's beginning a chain of events. It's like our mortgage crisis caused a chain of undoing events. Well, here was the farmers of the Midwest who defaulted their loans because they were hit hard by the economic downturn. No sooner did the first wave of bank runs subside than another got underway in the spring of 1931, creating what a contagion of fear among bank depositors. When that fear, what we call lack of confidence, comes, remember you hear that, lack of confidence? Mm-hmm. And lack of confidence is a psychological thing. It's not predictable. It's just simply psychological or emotional. But that will cause the market or people to do things that may, again, cause a downturn. And so how do you beef up confidence and, again, for them to enter, engage in marketing exchanges and keep, again, jobs and employment continuing and productivity continuing? It's iffy. And so rather than bank crisis continue to come waves until the spring of 1933, and each of those years in 1930, 32, or 33, what Friedman says is that if the Federal Reserve had stepped in and done what they're supposed to do, which is, again, supply them with the funds and give them the loans they needed, it would have stopped the bleeding in the banks and the collapse. But somehow they did not. In the main, it stood idle by and let the crisis take its course. A pattern of behavior that was to be repeated again and again during the next 2 years. And again, when you have a few men or one man in charge of the Federal Reserve, it's up to him. It's up to that small board to decide. Rather than let the market adjust itself, you're dependent upon the bank to step in or to come to the rescue, and it did not. And so these banks collapsed, being connected and dependent upon Federal Reserve management. Without the Fed, the same measures would have been taken in 1930 as in 1907. In other words, there would have been investors around who could have injected money in the bank and prevented this, but they were waiting for the Federal Reserve to act. And because it didn't, the banks had to go down. A restriction of, if they just restricted the withdrawal somehow and gave bank notes and promissory notes with interest, then the investors would have been satisfied because, again, it was to be made good later on. Economic recovery would very likely have begun in early 1931, just as in early 1908. By preventing the drain of reserves from good banks, restriction would almost certainly have prevented the subsequent series of bank failures in 1931, 32, and 33, just as restrictions in 1907 quickly ended bank failures then. The panic over and confidence restored. That's basically how do you restore confidence in the depositor, in the market. When we centralize great responsibility and power in one institution, its failure will have far-reaching and terrible consequences. When you centralize any, call it either education or, again, health care, if you will, just think about it now. I know it's a touchy subject. Housing, job security, if you centralize all that and you rely on one individual or a few, one body, to make decisions for the whole, it could have, if it makes a mistake, it will have wide-range disaster. Just think about it. All your eggs in one basket. It's like putting all your eggs in one basket. Someone making the decisions, monetary decisions, for you or for the whole nation. The institution failed because the people within it, see, it's the people who are on that board. It's a Bernanke. It's Greenspan. It's all those that were head making decisions for all the banks, all right? Our money is in their hands, right? How much it's worth is in their hands. You see that the value of it is in their hands, how much they put in and how much they take out. And given the immense power and influence it had over the economy, its failure was disastrous. So the Depression would not have been a Great Depression if there had been no Federal Reserve. That's important. If there were no Federal Reserve, there would not have been a Great Depression. Now, that's a new idea. We've been told that there was a Great Depression because of the crash. The Great Crash. Speculation. That free market doesn't work and it needs to be controlled. There needs to be regulation and of that. No, it's because the Federal Reserve was there and there was a dependency for it. Just like FEMA, Hurricane Katrina. They're just waiting for the, you know, what is it called? Calgary to come in. rather than individually being circle wagons and take care of your local sphere. That's what the independent institutions can do. We've got this mentality, again, of interdependency and waiting because you've got all this red tape, you've got all this hierarchy, right? You've got this bureaucratic channel you have to go through. And by the time you get it all filled out and all, it's disastrous. You see, it's time is not efficient. I mean, think about it.
Go ahead. When was the Federal Reserve developed?
1913. Mm-hmm. There were a total of 25,000 banks in the United States. As the bank holiday ended, only 12,000 banks were operating. A drastic fall in the money supply from 1929 to 1930, it fell by 27%. For every $3 in circulation in 1929, only $2 was left in 1933. Massive decrease in demand, again, the statistics are pretty raw. 25% unemployment of the whole nation. Talk about soup life. We had our soup life tonight, didn't we? But it was that disastrous. It was that desperate. Again, Reagan said we were hemorrhaging, economically hemorrhaging, dying as a nation. The gross domestic productivity was -8.6%, -6.4%, -13%, -1.3% in 1933. Then comes Franklin Delano Roosevelt as president. Right? He didn't cure it. 2 days later, he declared a bank holiday. In other words, a freeze. Don't go to the bank. and it lasted 10 days with his famous phrase. This is where he says, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. What does that mean? Okay. It's a nice phrase, but think about it. Well, again, fear is without faith. The people lost faith. Lost faith in the government. And he intended to sway depositors from running in their banks, but then it was far too late. And he started some programs, but they were failures. It aggravated the whole thing. What about our crisis today? What is the difference? I think when we look at it, in 1907, we had a J.P. Morgan, and the private sector took care of it. In 2007, we're drawing upon the future, and we're drawing upon the people's funds, our funds, our bailout, the government's funds, which they collect from us. But there were six government regulations and interventions that caused the mortgage crisis and the failed banks and the bailout. There were conditions that, remember, the free market was interfered by the federal government in the mortgage and in the housing industry and by these seven ways, six ways. Okay. Beginning with the Community Reinvestment Act of 1977, which said that forced lenders to give credit to low-income people who couldn't pay the loans back. Okay. That was imposed by the Community Reinvestment Act in 1977. Okay? And these types of loans increased September 99. And of course, why would lenders give money to individuals who couldn't pay it back? Well, President Clinton pressured banks to help poor people become homeowners. How did he do that? He threatened banks with lawsuits and fines, $10,000 per application for redlining or discriminating if they not make these loans. So it's to ignore sensible, reasonable policy for banking. And they said the government will guarantee these, okay? We will guarantee, we will back it with government money. So they went ahead and did it. Now, again, these are unintended consequences in the sense that, well, that's possible. I'm just going to go crazy, right? I'm going to go whole hog. It's going to be backed by the government funds, right? And I get credit for, I get points. I get points for all these loans I make and a bonus to boot. Because if I can accumulate, all right, all of this for business and all of this, then, of course, it adds to my resume. Okay? And they went after these kinds of loans because, again, if they were going to be punished, rather, let's be rewarded instead of being punished. And this is all the effort, again, of what we call another kind of entitlement. We're all entitled to have a house, somehow. Okay? That's the American dream, so to speak. Well, it became a nightmare. And not only this, the state and local government saw that, wait a minute, if I put all these regulations on building and limit the building process, that each home will cost more. And the price of a home determines your property taxes. And property taxes go to the state. And so they can get in on this too. If I make it difficult, because the demand for houses is so great, if supply is limited, the houses will cost more, right? And it's to my advantage to restrict house building so that the price will go up since the demand is so high, and we'll just get more revenue for our state, our town. I mean, that makes sense to me. So that compounds things, right? And these inflated prices, because of it's interfering in the free exchange. It's a third party. By now, it's five party interference, okay? The Federal Reserve System brought interest rates down. They kept the cost of borrowing money down so those loans can keep going. And you paid only interest at the beginning, okay, which was low. That was inviting until the principal kicked in. It was artificially low. Artificially low. And so the Reserve System prevented the failure.
Yeah.
All right, they kept the default payments afloat, as it were, or discounted them. And this is the perfect storm? All these six things coming together at a particular time, it was a perfect storm. It's just the bubble burst. Congress demanded that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy more of these Christie loans to help the poor. Since the mortgages purchased and guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are backed by the U.S. government, the loans were resold primarily to investment banks, which in turn bundled most of them, taking a hefty fee, and sold the mortgages to investors all the world as virtually risk-free. And China bought a lot of these.
Yes.
Okay, that's entanglement. And, of course, we have Burns with it.
Bear Stearns
and Lehman. Okay. Approximately 6% of all mortgage loans in the United States are in default. Historically, they're less than one-third, from 2% to 2%. They call subprime loans. Most of the subprime loans have been made to borrowers with poor credit ratings. No down payment, amazing. On home finance and or no verification of income. Amazing. Or assets. No collateral. Okay. You just walk in, sign, and you're a homeowner. Okay. So these two institutions, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, collapsed. It's not a failure of the free market, because lending institutions in a free market would not have taken on the high risk loans. Yes.
So much for Greenspan's comment then. Oops, I made a mistake. The free markets don't work. That's a quote from him.
Yeah. You know what he didn't count on? Criminal activity.
Right.
It's not that free market doesn't work, but the criminal activity, that bad policy produces corruption. It opens the door to corruption. Try that at home. Have a bad policy. You know that. Right? They find all the loopholes and they have you over a barrel, okay? They use the policy against you if it's not wise. True?
That's why they're not going to buy it.
That's right. They show them how to do that. Okay? Same thing with human nature.
I'm sorry. This isn't free market, though.
No, it's not. It's interference. It's interference. And Federal Reserve is not free market. It's interference.
We don't have free market.
No,
we haven't had it.
The solution is not, and this is important, the solution is not a taxpayer finance bailout. The solution is to let them fail. That's, now, see, we don't like people to fail. Right? That's not nice.
If we fail, then what would happen? We'd have expression.
That's right.
Well,
no, we can prevent, well, not necessarily so, because that just itself, I mean, those that committed error ought to pay for the error.
I agree.
And shut down. We had shut down. Banks had to shut down because Washington Mutual took all those loans. That's why they. I go to Washington Mutual, and you should have seen the tellers when I walked in that day. They couldn't even look you in the eye. They were so embarrassed to be a part of this bank because it was shut down, bought by Chase.
They didn't shut
Wahoo,
did they?
No, they didn't shut Wahoo, but they knew they couldn't smile at me. Hello? it's demoralizing when you're attached to
that. We should do a lesson on greed.
We all know about that one. Okay, the solution is to let them fail and listen. Sometimes you have to let your children suffer consequences for their mistakes. Yeah. They're not too far from the ground, okay?
Yeah.
Right. But they're still under your roof, all right? And allow the people who invest in them, as well as the people who purchase homes they couldn't afford, suffer the losses. This is a proper correction, is it not? Secondarily, now, what else might happen? If Americans are going to be on the hook to bail out these government-sponsored enterprises, don't you think we should know who's responsible? All right. Accounting, fraud, and deception. By the way, they don't keep books in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac like you normally would in a business, right? So accounting was a problem. Now, we crucify Enron and the people for their bad practices. And what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And everyone needs to be accountable for mismanagement of federal funds. They shall keep talking about the. They all keep talking about this is the best solution. This is what's on our plate to do. What we can do about it to resist the decline or counter the decline and shorten the depression if we have one. All right, what is that? They all keep talking about getting the bailout approved so the economy can get going and what? We can spend.
Yeah.
Okay? Borrowing money again from banks again. People borrow to pay off debt. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And they borrow to pay off that debt.
Right.
And it just balloons and balloons.
Yeah.
Before you know, you can't make the payments. Whether businesses or individuals and essentially accumulate even more debt, you see, they want to keep us in debt.
Mm-hmm.
They want to keep us paying to the Federal Reserve. They keep talking about credit and borrowing. Shouldn't they be instead preaching saving?
Yeah.
Or buying only when you can afford it and pay cash?
Right.
That is the way to resist the impending potential depression. They should, but they won't because our banking system and the flow of currency relies on our need to borrow. So that we can consume and consume and consume, waste and waste, eventually leading to conspicuous consumption and, of course, astounding debt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are programs that want to keep you in debt, not get you out of debt.
They make money from you.
That's right. They get points.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we all suddenly stop borrowing money, this is a hard one. If we all suddenly stop borrowing money, no credit cards, no car loans, no mortgage. And instead live strictly within our means. That's not so hard, is it? There would be no new money created and we would have no economy. We live in an economy that encourages and even requires us to spend instead of save. Does that make any sense? We are essentially slaves to the banks, even the government, and there's a good reason why. You know, indebtedness is slavery.
Mm-hmm.
You're working for the bank.
Yeah.
Okay? As Ansel Rothschild, one of our earliest, most powerful bankers, once said, permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws. Okay, whoever controls the money controls the nation. It should be in Congress. It's supposed to be in Congress's hands, not with your private individuals. J.P. Morgan and his fellow bankers use their own money while the Federal Reserve System used their power to create money. And that's the difference between 1907 and 2007. We can use our own money by not borrowing, by not creating more debt. That's a way of resisting the decline and potential depression. Again, he's comparing here what happened in 1907 and 2007. The big difference between this year's rescue to stabilize the financial markets and that 100 years ago is that this year's government rescue leads to demands that still more rescues, including real bailouts, should extend to homeowners. People will say, what about me? If you can bail out the banks, why can't you bail out some of the rest of us? What's the principle involved, right? Where do you draw the line? There is no line. It's selective. Whatever the government does sets a precedent, causes more special interests to demand that they get the same treatment. It's fair, right? You're particularly right. The value of money goes down the more Federal Reserve notes are issued to subsidize the purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan. So we all pay to keep Bear Stearns out of bankruptcy. Okay. That's basically what Thomas Sowell observed. Government intervention, which the Great Depression beyond that of other depressions, where the government did nothing, which caused the financial crisis of 2008. So the idea of intervening. Notice the stock market crash in 1908. For instance, when President Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt intervened, they made the matters worse. The stock market crash of 1987 was at least as big as the stock market crash in 1929. But instead of being followed by a Great Depression, the 1987 crash was followed by 20 years of economic growth and low inflation and low unemployment. What happened? The Reagan administration did nothing in 1987 so that markets could adjust. He let it adjust itself. You know, what is it? We lost, 900 or 800 points in the stock market, and then the next day, it bounded. It's just that way. It adjusts itself. What people sell, others buy. Because the prices go down, you what? Buy low, sell high. Okay? Some people can't stand it, so they sell. And those who can't stand it, buy. You see? And that's how the market goes. And that's why it's free, in that way, it's freer that way. It does adjust. It can adjust. It's a roller coaster ride. It's ulcerating.
It's gambling.
It is. But it's risk. But what are you trusting in? The freedom to choose. The freedom for individuals. And you can't predict what some people do, will not do. Because we're all individuals. Ronald Reagan resisted loud calls for him to intervene. The result was not another Great Depression, but the beginning of decades-long period of prosperity. It's not wise for one person or group of persons to have so much power over our economy. That's basically it. Centralizing something. If Congress passed laws that will enable politicians to micromanage businesses, that is a proven formula for big economic problems for a long time to come, says Thomas Sowell. In 100 years, we go from capitalism and free enterprise to nationalization and socialism. The most remarkable period of government intervention into the financial system since the Great Depression. That's just where we are. Some people even believe that whenever there is a market failure, the government ought to step in. The Bush bailout, as well as Federal Reserve Bank cuts and interest rates, is a wealth transfer from creditworthy people and taxpayers to those who make ill-advised credit decisions, right? We're just transferring our funds into their pockets. And that includes banks as well as borrowers. The idea of a stimulus package is based on the general notion, and is accepted, by the way, that there are things the government could do to make things better in the economy. Again, inviting it. This is what I observe. The character of the American people in general. See, okay, I'm giving us a break here. Disposed to invite nationalization, centralization, and independency. Upon the all-powerful government into the economy of their lives. Weak, because we're weak against pressures of expediency, right? We can't wait. We're not patient enough. We're patient in suffering, or we don't want to. We're resistant to correction and consequences. And we're selfish. We have a selfish disregard for posterity. Because, really, who's going to pay it? Your grandchildren? It's on their backs. Now, where's the hope? Erroneous ideas and actions serve always to advance the right ideas and hurries it along to the fore, brings it forward, where before these ideas were neither acknowledged nor welcomed, okay? Thank you very much. Isn't that true? And when the pain comes, you look for a cure. And what was a bad idea before seems to look pretty good now. It's like saying to your mother when you're growing up, boy, you are so smart then, right? I didn't think you were so smart when I was little, but all of a sudden you look so wise to me now, after you've lived a little bit.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. Some ideas, free market or whatever, seem crazy, ridiculous without government intervention and help. Mm-hmm. But now when we're knee deep in you know what, okay, not so bad idea. Maybe we ought to go back to, maybe we ought to think again. The pressures of adversity and pain of correction pauses headlong motion and stirs deep reflection for relief and resolution. Individually first, what are you going to do? What's your economy going to look like as we decline? Because the decline is here. It is coming. It is here. And regardless of what the nation does, what will you do? Because whatever you do is going to affect your nation. Do you understand that? It's a cumulative. And in your local sphere, you can spare yourself minimal damage, collateral damage, as they say. Because you really now have to look out for your self-interest. Right? Now, self-interest is not selfish interest. Don't confuse the two terms. Self-interest is your private business. You look after your private affairs. Don't wait for somebody else to take care of your private affairs. If you do that, selfish interest is your interest at the expense of somebody else. That's selfish. And we've been selfish because we've concerned ourselves without thinking about the future, the next generation. That's what's up. The generation that's not been born yet, so who cares, right? I don't even see them. That's short-sighted. Absolutely, because then as you go, so the nation will go, so to speak. So something for you to think about. Okay, thank you.